You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702.
More than a radio station.
Let's walk the talk.
Professor Charles Perry, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time. This is quite unprecedented that we had not one trauma case at Baragwanath Hospital during this past weekend.
Yeah, indeed, and also not one at New Somerset Hospital. I think not one at Victoria Hospital, only six at Critisphere, 12 at Tigerberg. So it really is unprecedented, but as you said, a ban is quite a stringent measure. We need to look at other ways to try and get effects in the same direction, even if they're not quite as good as a full ban.
I say that because somebody said Dr. Charles Perry has a wine cellar in his house but says alcohol should be banned. I don't know if you do have a wine cellar in your house, Professor Charles Perry, but you're clearly not calling for a ban on the sale of alcohol, one. Two, some listeners have raised the idea that perhaps the fact that we didn't see those trauma cases has got nothing to do with the limitations on the sale of alcohol, but rather because of the curfew. How do you respond to that?
No, I mean, I think you also said it's a combination of both, but in fact, the ban does have a role to play. When you study the data from the Western Cape Sentinel Trauma Surveillance System, and I know you were talking to Keith Clutty earlier, it's so clear that at times when in fact, before we had the first lockdown on the 27th of March, there was what we called lockdown light,
yeah,
which really just was controlled on alcohol sales. There was no curfew. And in fact, even then, we saw a drop in the hospital admissions and ambulance call-outs. So, you know, and analyses that we did are looking at non-natural deaths, and we took into account in level 3B when there was a shift from 1 hour, and in fact, it had a very small effect on the deaths compared to the alcohol ban. So no, it's not the curfew, but obviously it is related. And when you have a curfew, people aren't buying alcohol as well. So they're not independent, and it's certainly not. No one's saying it's just the alcohol ban, but certainly when I've looked at the data, you can see that a large part of it is due to the ban and not the curfew. And we know that from looking at when there was just a shift in 1 hour in the curfew, it really didn't have such a huge impact. It was the ban on sales.
Well, Prof, I don't know if it's the ban on sales. I can tell you right now that there was alcohol, right, over this weekend. People had alcohol, whether it was because they'd bought it before the ban announced by the president, or whether it was being bought illegally from various outlets, or whatever the case may be. I can almost say that if I opened up the lines now, people would tell me that there was booze. Isn't that perhaps a counter argument to the idea that it was in fact the non-availability of alcohol in terms of sales that gave us this outcome? And is it not perhaps important for us to look a little closer to understand the dynamics of the relationship between the curfew and the non-sale of alcohol in order to find the real reason, a concrete reason as to why we are seeing this desired outcome of the reduction in alcohol-related traumas?
Certainly, I've got to interrogate the data. You can't just push agendas without looking at the data. So I'm glad you're raising that. One of the things that I got from colleagues living in Tembisa and places like that was telling me the prices of alcohol it went up, it doubled, it went up by three times, for example.
Yeah.
So yes, people were getting alcohol, but it was at a higher price.
Yeah.
And there's certainly a lot of information around pricing affects consumption. So maybe people were having seven drinks instead of 10,
yeah,
and they were spending the same amount of money on seven or five instead of 10. And that's the theory behind minimum unit pricing, which is something we're also calling for in the future. But yes, it is. It's complex, and the curfew and or the lack of the ban on sales certainly has put up prices.
Yeah.
But it's over a longer period of time. there becomes less alcohol available. Obviously, we were just looking at a few days after the ban on sales came in. So obviously, there's a lot of liquor around, and people maybe anticipated this on the Monday and bought more. But over time, there's a squeeze, and prices do go up, and that's where you see the impact. And then obviously, the closing of outlets at a certain time of day, people aren't out there drinking and getting into fights and things like that. So, yeah, it's not going to be as magic a bullet if we look at a basket of other measures. But certainly we would be crazy just to put our heads in the sand and when the ban on sales is lifted and say that it's fine, we'll go back to where we were. That would be crazy because we're going to keep repeating these periodic liquor sales bans throughout 2021 if we don't come up with some concrete lesser measures than a ban to try and, you know, let people have their alcohol but not have so much of the negative side effects and the huge insane levels of trauma that we see particularly over weekends at our hospitals.
What is the significance of the fact that we've had three temporary alcohol sales bans? Prof, I know that you've said something to that effect. Why is that important?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if anyone's really learning from it. It seems to me that we've missed an opportunity after the first sales ban was lifted and after the second sales ban was lifted to do something so that we didn't, you know, have the third sales ban. And I think what it tells me is how many times do we have to go through this before we see real leadership from government in saying, you know, they're talking to industry at NEDLAC, but that's not coming up with anything concrete, and it's unlikely to. So we really, this isn't rocket science. We know from a whole range of research done around the world of which strategies are likely to have an impact on reducing harmful consumption of alcohol. And the trouble is in this country, we just not putting that plan on the table. It could be because we have different government departments, agriculture, health, social development, trade and industry, and so they're not really working together. And so we're not really learning the lessons that we should be. We should be having a discussion like we had last night with the Minister of Health around an advisory group around what we should be doing to do with alcohol. And that's not happening. That's very disappointing.
Well, I certainly hope that the relevant departments are listening to this conversation, because clearly the desired outcome, at least from a medical point of view, and to perhaps a lesser extent from a point of view of social peace, and less trauma. We are seeing that the desired outcome of less trauma cases is what we are presented with every time we have these bans. But of course, Prof, we are a country that is a democracy. We have certain civil liberties. I would imagine that for government, certain political considerations come into play when they think about this conversation. How do we massage this conversation into the national consciousness of the country? But what are some of those strategies that you say are already in place in some countries that wouldn't disturb our sense of liberty and choice, but would also not take away from the economic contribution that this industry makes? What are those strategies?
Sure. No, I mean, I agree with you completely. I hate people telling me what to do if it doesn't make sense, you know. So, you know, anyway, so I think there are things we can look, for example, to what happened in Russia when there was a huge problem with harmful use of alcohol. Life expectancy for men was very low. I think it was like 45 years. And huge amounts of social issues and problems and illegal selling and things like that. And there's a whole lot of ideas around that, what we could do differently, which would allow the industry to continue to operate, but they cannot continue to operate by making their money from people drinking at harmful levels. So either they've got to have more people drinking less, or we've got to have, they've got to find other ways to diversify. But certainly we need to look at things like minimum unit pricing, a minimum floor price below which alcohol can't be sold. You can buy bag-in-a-box wines here for sometimes less than R3 a standard drink. That's way too low. We should be having probably a minimum unit price of R5 a standard drink in South Africa.
Are you saying to me we need to get rid of the pop sack, Prof?
Well, we don't have pop sucks, but we have bag and boxes, and we have things called rooitroppies, which are bottles with red caps, which is very cheap wines or ale in there. And I think they need to go out of the market. I mean, people are saying, well, then the poor people won't drink alcohol. Well, they will, but we have many people who are drinking sort of 8-10 drinks when they are on a drinking occasion, and maybe they'll only be able to afford 6 or 7. Well, that's tough, but I mean, that's maybe something we should be looking at. Other things like independent pre-betting of alcohol advertisements. We currently rely on self-regulation, and I think that should be taken out of the industry's hands. We have some of our container sizes are just too big. We see the beer containers getting bigger and bigger. Mm. Our 1.5-liter beer bottles, 1-liter black label, and the price comes down. I think we should probably set maximum container sizes, for example, 500 mils for beer or 750 max, and 750 for a bottle of wine and so on, bottle of wine. We also have a lot of illegal alcohol or alcohol sold through unregulated outlets. And one of the things they found that worked in Russia was having QR codes on the containers. And by doing that, they could see where the containers were coming from and could go back up the supply chain and stop illegal sales of alcohol. We also need better data on how we're doing in terms of harm, and so we can see whether policies are working. It sounds like we have good data on trauma in South Africa. We don't actually. The Western Cape is the only province which actually has a sentinel trauma surveillance system that collects data from 5 hospitals, and that's been running from January. But there isn't such a system in any of the other provinces. And I think we need to expand that. There are talks of expanding it, and it needs to include alcohol-related trauma. And a single finger prick test, like you do for blood glucose, could easily be done on everybody coming to the trauma unit, so we could look at blood alcohol levels. And then we could see how many people are coming to the trauma units with alcohol, how is it linked to violence and injury, and females and males and so on. And we could also see whether we have an impact over time to see whether we're making a difference. So having good data will also affect good policy design and implementation. And drink driving, we're talking of dropping the BAC, maximum BAC level to zero. I think it should be 0.02, and we need also better enforcement to get on top of drink driving. But basically, the main thing we need is leadership from government. Yeah. We need a coherent national strategy and good policy implementation. And we really have a very laissez-faire approach, and we tend to rely on cooperation and self-regulation by industry. And clearly, it's not working.
Is there, in your opinion, which is my final question to you, Prof, do you think that there is a real understanding of the impact the abuse of alcohol has on society from an economic point of view, from just a trauma point of view, from a social cohesion point of view? Is there a genuine understanding from the powers that be in order to engage in a conversation such as this?
Well, I think, we keep pushing this. I mean, I think they've heard the message, whether it's getting through, and there's data going to be released in 2021 from the Medical Research Council on the new burden of disease estimates, which are going to give for a whole range of health issues the link and how much alcohol is causing the harms in terms of premature death and disability. So that data will be coming out later this year. But we've had this data in the past. We've had data showing the huge economic costs, probably twice what you get in excise tax is the direct measurable economic harms to South Africa, and much more than that when you're looking at the intangible costs. So that data is there. We've got it across, and it just doesn't seem to be getting translated into action, and that's the problem. And I think we can't continue to rely on a situation where not only we have, perhaps 5 or 6 out of 10 drinkers engaging in binge drinking monthly and huge amounts of problems, but we also have an industry which is dependent on that group drinking heavily in order to make the profits they desire. So we've got to change the business model, which is fundamentally flawed for large parts of the industry. Not saying for all parts, but for large parts. The beer industry, for example, is dependent on this heavy drinking culture to make the profits they need. So we need to deal with that as well. It looks at production quotas, maybe all sorts of things like that.
Professor Charles Perry, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Aubrey.
All right. Professor Charles Perry is Director of the Alcohol, Tobacco and Other Drug Research Unit at the South African Medical Research Council.